This podcast is brought to you by Intel vPro.
I'm just really unhappy with everybody right now, except the people right here in this room on this podcast.
This is Impromptu from Washington Post Opinions. It's a news show where we take you into the conversations behind the columns. Each week, we bring on the columnist best suited to take on the news of the moment. This week, we're getting into a topic that everybody seems to have an opinion about, the clashes that have spread across American college campuses over Israel, Palestine, and free speech, and how all these things tangle with U.S. politics. Today, we want to talk about the bigger ideas behind this conflict, free speech, yes, but also the sensitivity of the Israel-Gaza war among young people, the fractures the protests have exposed, and what these disagreements and their exploitation mean for the election. I'm Amanda Katz, Senior Opinions Editor, and I'm joined today by two of my colleagues.
I'm Dana Milbank. I'm a columnist at The Washington Post.
And hi, I'm Shadi Hamid. I'm also a columnist at The Washington Post.
So here's where we are. Pro-Palestinian students across the country have set up encampments to protest the war in Gaza. The protesters want an immediate ceasefire, and many are asking universities to divest from investments connected to Israel and weapons manufacturers. Though many of these protests actually include Jewish students, there have been some anti-Semitic incidents both on and off campus, and universities are facing pressure over anti-Semitism all the way up to the halls of Congress. Some have called in police to arrest protesting students and faculty. Some have canceled classes and even graduations. Dana, I'd love to start with a question for you. Last October, following the Hamas attacks, you wrote a column expressing deep concern about acts of anti-Semitism on campuses by pro-Palestinian supporters and critiquing some on the far left for attacking Israel's very right to exist. How have your feelings evolved in the last 6 months, and how does what's happening now affect how you think about it?
You know, Amanda, if it's possible, I think there's even more anguish now. Because then it was a sense that, okay, well, this terrible attack happened on October 7th. Obviously, Israel has to step in and defend itself. So then, yeah, it was feeling like there was a bit of hurt that my usual allies on the left were not necessarily seeing it the way I saw and the way other American Jews see it. I mean, face it, you know, 80% of American Jews tend to vote Democratic, overwhelmingly see themselves as progressives. Very few American Jews actually vote based on Israel. It's more about domestic issues and social issues. So it sort of felt like a betrayal from a lot, and I know a lot of American Jews felt this way, like we had been there at various other times, you know, after the 9/11 attacks, you know, standing up to anti-Muslim hatred and violence and civil rights and LGBTQ with everything else. And it just sort of felt like, well, okay, maybe this was an exception. And why did it feel like it was sort of open season on American Jews? Or why did it feel like the Jews were the only ones who were not entitled to a homeland? So it was that sort of thing. But of course, you know, what's changed since then is the horror of the last 6 months and just this, you know, the outrage of the Netanyahu regime. I don't think I'd even call it an administration. It's disgraceful. I'm certainly not here to defend anything that the government of Israel is doing right now. So, of course, we're just as anguished as anybody else who's out there, but also really alarmed by, I'm sure it's the minority of people out there in the demonstrations, but, you know, there is a real vein of anti-Semitism and hostility, not just to the Netanyahu regime, but to the right of Israel to exist. So that's sort of the mixture of emotions.
Shadi, I will ask you the same question. How have your feelings or politics on Israel and Gaza evolved since October 7th?
Yeah, so where some people after October 7th moved to the right, I've sort of been the opposite case, that I've found myself over the past 6 months shifting leftwards and feeling more sympathy towards progressivism and progressive causes. I have historically been a progressive, but I would say in recent years, you know, especially on things, the so-called woke wars and cultural issues, I had been critical of the left flank in the Democratic Party, and I had felt that there had been excesses coming out of the George Floyd protests in 2020, that it was a good cause, but then you had overreach And then there were examples of cancel culture and just a stifling of free speech. But I'm someone who is very critical of Israel's conduct in the war. I'm outraged by it. And it's been really hard for me to process just the sheer level of destruction, the death toll. And I think that progressives do have a better lens where they say, look, you know, I think most progressives would say that what Hamas did on October 7th was horrific and unjustifiable. But then what Israel has done afterwards is unjustifiable and indefensible, and that there is here a clear case of an oppressor and an oppressed, and the Palestinian people find themselves in this very weak and difficult position. So this is where I think I have started to feel a little bit more solidarity with some of the progressives on campus who are maybe not being moderate. Certainly some of their language is excessive. And here I'm not talking about anti-Semitism. I'm just talking about alienating things. Like, don't say from the river to the sea. I've been critical of that from the beginning. I don't think that's anti-Semitic, but I do think it's alienating. I do think that many American Jews take that as an offensive thing that really hurts them. And for the pro-Palestine movement, I think it's important to build a larger tent. And I think they're not doing a great job of that. So I have my criticisms there. But at the end of the day, I do sympathize with the fact that there are a growing number of young protesters on campus who have felt like they've reached their limit and they want to have an avenue to express their anger over the Gaza war and America's role in the war.
Shadi, I think what you're saying gets at something that's been really notable more broadly, which is that I think that this conflict seems like it's scrambling a lot of the traditional or sort of what have been the recent political camps around free speech. In recent years, the right has made a huge cause of free speech on campus, but they've been mostly talking about the concerns about the suppression of conservative speech. And now you see conservative politicians pressuring university presidents not to allow these protests on the basis that they're anti-Semitic and to chill that speech. And Speaker Mike Johnson even traveled to Columbia to talk about that. Do you feel, when you look at this at campuses, do you feel like pro-Palestinian speech is being treated differently than free speech of other kinds? Like, do you see a distinction about how it's being handled?
I think that double standard has really been striking for me. I guess this is human nature. If you don't like a cause and you think it's bad, and Republicans in particular don't tend to be very sympathetic to Palestinian suffering. So I think you see a lot of Republicans who really think that the pro-Palestine movement is just bad. And they're less likely to support free speech when it's a cause they don't support. And I think it's been sad to see that when it comes down to it, most people don't have strong, consistent principles. And they like the speech they agree with, and they don't like the speech they disagree with. And I think what Dana said is really important. There are a minority of statements and slogans that we've seen that are anti-Semitic, but I would really emphasize the word minority here. I haven't seen any evidence that this is representative of the general whole. Of course, any anti-Semitic slogan is one too much. But I think what I've been troubled by is the sort of desire among some people to kind of cast a very wide net and say that all of these protest encampments are fundamentally motivated by anti-Semitism. And I think that's something that I've been trying to challenge because I just think it's not true and also just unfair. And it's part of this deeper desire to delegitimize what is otherwise, I think, a just and worthy movement.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about that, Dana? Because I think there has been, I mean, I certainly have reacted to this a lot as a Jewish person and seeing people call these protests anti-Semitic, sometimes mm-hmm. even without even really making a case for it. But there's clearly a lot of conflation of anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism that's happening.
Yeah, there's been a whole lot of that. this revolves around this whole question, you know, is anti-Zionism anti-Semitism? And okay, well, it depends on what, you know, what we're using. Like, I call myself a Zionist because I believe that there should be a Jewish homeland. That's the extent of the definition. Nothing in there endorses anything that this particular Israeli government.
So for you, that doesn't imply support of settlements or being aggressive.
Absolutely not.
Right.
It's outrageous. In fact, my rabbi says that he believes the Netanyahu regime is the first truly anti-Zionist government of Israel, because it is. I mean, you know, Israel was created by the Labor Party, the labor movement. It was a creation of the left. And it has, you know, this incarnation is not something they would recognize at all, this kind of nationalist and truthfully racist state that it has become under Netanyahu in many ways. You know, on the free speech argument, yes, of course, everybody wants more of the speech that they agree with. And there's one reason why Mike Johnson went to Columbia, and that is to further the divisions that he perceives on the left, because he believes that's going to benefit him. And I suspect he's right about that. And that's what worries me about the protests. First of all, they have a right to protest. I think we completely overdo it and say, it's my First Amendment right, or it's my civil disobedience. It's like, okay, you know, First Amendment does not grant you the power to, you know, set up a tent and ignore the university regulations.
Well, universities have rules, too.
They have rules, right. The First Amendment is about the government. This is
Absolutely.
Not involving the government. You don't have a First Amendment right when you're, you know, heckling somebody in their backyard.
Well, you're saying all kinds of honor codes and things.
Right, okay. So we could, you know, there's a smaller argument about that. There's a smaller argument about, you know, civil disobedience, you know, people, you know, facing arrest or facing expulsion, now signing petitions saying we should not be punished. But to me, the whole notion of it is you agree to be punished. You face the consequences. That's what civil disobedience is. So, you know, but I think those are minor issues compared to the schism that is occurring on the left here. And I think it's sort of needless, because what we're seeing on the campus now, I'm afraid, is just kind of an appetizer for what we're going to see at the Democratic Convention in Chicago. What I'm worried is this is going to play itself out, you know, split Democrats in the election, return Donald Trump to the White House, which is the worst possible thing, I would argue, for Israel, but certainly also for the people of Gaza, for the Mideast, and just about everybody else in the world.
Shadi, how do you see it among people you're talking to? Like, I know you've written a lot about how this issue affects Arab American and Muslim American voters.
So honestly, among my Arab and Muslim American friends and family, I would say most of them, at least as of the current moment, are saying that they're not sure they'll be able to vote for Biden, that it's going to be a close call when they're in the voting booth. Some are more explicit, like after what's happened, no way. They're going to abstain, stay home, where others are, it's more of a kind of pain thing where they're like, we know that it's better for Biden to be president, but voting is a matter of conscience. It's a very personal thing. And some people have met their threshold where they don't think they can necessarily sleep at night and also cast their vote for Joe Biden. But it's not just Arab and Muslim Americans. I think young voters, we've seen a lot of polling how just the sheer amount of disapproval and criticism of the Biden administration's policy seems considerable there. But also among Democrats writ large, there was a March Gallup poll where 75% of Democrats said that they oppose Israel's war in Gaza. So I think that you are seeing this broader shift in the Democratic Party among ordinary Democrats, but it hasn't been reflected in the Democratic Party leadership. In the Israel aid bill recently, only 37 out of 213 House members voted no. That's only 17% of the Democratic caucus. So here I think you see a complete disconnect between where the party is and where a lot of Democrats are. And that's going to be a major problem, I think, come November.
Okay, I want to get more into the generational differences at play here, but we have to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
This podcast is brought to you by Intel vPro. AI PCs built for business with Intel Core Ultra processors and Intel vPro are optimized for hundreds of AI apps and tools to boost user productivity, all with AI-powered threat detection. Learn more at intel.com/itheroes.
There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
Welcome back. I'm Amanda Katz, and this is Impromptu. So one thing about the protests happening, as you just alluded to, Shadi, is there are a lot of generational differences that are happening here. You know, if you are 27, you've never really known a pre-Netanyahu Israel. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot about how that affects the mentality.
Right.
Like what Israel means to someone who's
right.
a voter who's 23.
Right.
You know, they've watched
yes.
what is the sort of more
that's
nationalist
right.
right-wing Israel that you
right.
were talking
and
about
I
earlier.
Think they need to be told and reminded. And that's, I guess that's part of what I've been writing in my columns. And, you know, and as you know, as saying earlier, why my rabbi says this is an anti-Zionist government. This is not what it's supposed to be in Israel.
Right. That's a very sort of nuanced distinction, right? If people have to figure out, I mean, I completely understand yeah. what you're saying, but I think people have to understand then, you know,
I think it can be very simple. Jews have a right to a homeland. So do the Palestinians. They had a right to defend themselves. They do not have a right to continue to do what they want. Well, they have a right to do it, I suppose, but they're going to lose the entire world community, including the United States. But, you know, I just see a clear, bright line between right of Israel to exist and atrocious policies that this particular government is
right.
following right now. And
yeah.
I just like, I feel like surely this is something 95% of us can wrap our arms around here,
right.
I think.
And in fairness, I think there are many people who are at these protests who would mm-hmm. absolutely agree that Israel
so.
Has a right that's, to exist.
I
you know,
so.
I don't think
yeah.
that's the terms yeah. that many people mm-hmm. are there on.
But,
what do you say,
I would say that the number of pro-Palestine activists who support a so-called one-state solution or a binational state is growing. That is something that I hear more, certainly from Arab and Muslim Americans who say, well, I'm still sort of old school in that I still think a two-state solution, as Dana just outlined, is the only realistic option. I don't think it's right to correct one. If you consider the founding of Israel to be an injustice, you don't correct that injustice with another one and say, well, oh, now we have to dissolve the Jewish homeland and make it a kind of a broader state that includes everyone. Obviously, a lot of Israelis who are born and raised in Israel aren't going to be thrilled about losing the only state they know. But I think, unfortunately, because the two-state solution has seemed like a dead end for such a long time, and the Netanyahu government has worked so hard to thwart aspirations for a two-state solution that a lot of people are saying, well, hey, we tried that with the Oslo peace process and all these different peace negotiations. You know, maybe it's time for something new and different where both peoples can live under a kind of confederated structure. Obviously, like, there's a lot of disagreement about how that would work out. I don't think it's realistic, as I said. But, you know, I do think that is a growing sentiment, unfortunately, from my standpoint. But I think I get where people are coming from, that they've lost hope in the old formulas. They've heard two-state solution and peace process in quotation marks for years, if not decades. And they're like, what has this gotten us?
Right. And I think for younger voters, they don't even, like, there was a time in the 90s where that felt like a, you know, there were sort of glimmers of real possibility around that and a sort of political momentum around it that feels so vanished, you know, so that I don't feel like they've seen a lot of interest from Israel's government in that.
Yeah, although, I mean, this is maybe odd in this sort of a discussion, but, you know, how about one note of optimism here? And it, you know, it looks like the Saudis want to normalize relations with Israel. The cost to being what Netanyahu refuses to do and endorse a two-state solution. You know, there's actually, you know, some hope that out of this nightmare, there could be some sort of a realignment. The reason I brought that up is I think that's what Biden needs to do as an answer to all the people. He needs to use his leverage that he has now with Netanyahu and with Israel to say, look, you gotta work with the Saudis and come to terms here. I think that is what he needs to do to win back some of the people he has lost there. But if I may, I'm wondering, you know, beyond that sort of a change in policy, what can be said to somebody who is saying, look, I'm just not going to vote for that dude no matter what the consequences are? Because I just, you can see, I want to pull what a little hair I have out, like, because the consequences are horrible. So,
yeah, it's a tough question. And I'm sort of two minds on this. Let's say hypothetically, Biden came tomorrow and said that he no longer believes in a woman's right to choose, something that is just very fundamental to a big portion of the Democratic Party women, but also just more broadly in the party. I can imagine that there'd be a lot of Democrats who would say, well, oh, Biden has this position that we consider to be so fundamental to what we believe in, that even if Biden is great on everything else and will protect us against Trump on all the other issues we care about, because he's shifted his position in a negative direction on this one issue, sorry, we're not going to be able to muster the ability to vote for him. I think for a lot of the people that I talk to, it's a similar sentiment that for them, Gaza has hit so hard. And I think for a lot of Muslim Americans, there's a sense of our own government just being very callous towards Arab and Muslim lives and Palestinian suffering. And you can even see Biden. He just doesn't feel Palestinian suffering the way he does Israeli suffering. He just doesn't. And he said a number of things, questioning the death toll, making light of a death toll, just not talking as much about, you know, Palestinians and what they're actually going through. And when he does, it doesn't have the same kind of emotional register. I think that just cuts at something very deep for a lot of people when they watch their own president and they say, he just doesn't see us. He just doesn't see Arabs as being equally deserving of human rights. Now, people can kind of take issue with that characterization. I'm just trying here to convey.
That's the perception.
And that's why when I hear people who are just really pained and it's just coming at a very like deep psychic level for them, because you can try to come up with all the rational arguments well and remind them Trump is dangerous on all these other things that you care about.
And they might also not become Trump voters, but they might not turn out for Biden.
Oh, yeah, precisely. I'm not saying they'd vote for Trump, but they would abstain.
Abstain
and then
voting.
People would say, well, abstaining is effectively a vote for Trump in battleground states. But they would say, hey, Shadi, we get it. Mm. We see what you're saying. But, like, we got to draw the line somewhere.
Right. I want to ask you another question that's forward-looking to the election in that way. This weekend, I had a conversation with a Democratic strategist who said, you know, the conventions are coming up. She expressed a lot of concern that there would be violence at the conventions. You know, we're watching footage of riot police cracking down on students, arresting faculty. I mean, there's, you know, suspensions threatened. Like, the temperature's getting pretty hot. Dan, I mean, one thing I wonder about is what could academic and political leaders do to lower the temperature? Like, if the goal is to kind of put things back together, do you see any, and if you have any shining examples of that, I would love to hear them. Give us a little hope here.
Yeah, I've shared my optimism. That was my brief nugget of optimism.
I feel like that was an optimism from September last year. Hamas didn't love that idea.
I'm still clinging to it, just a tiny bit of it. Look, I'm sure the administrators had the right to do what they did. It just seems it may have been just sort of a tactical error because, you know, they didn't need the police. They just needed summer break. Which was going to happen in just a few days.
I know. A lot of the suggestions I've seen online have been that, you know, what they could have done here is nothing. Yeah. And that would have been really effective.
Yeah. My daughter is a sophomore up at Yale, and she said, you know, even at its peak, it wasn't like the majority of the campus was out there. You know, the immediate thing that the protesters on the campus are asking for is, right, divestment from Israel, from arms companies. Now, of course, even if every university in America today said, okay, right, we're going to do all of that, It wouldn't actually change anything.
Right, it puts a limited amount of pressure on Israel still.
On the ground. So in that sense, there's huge anger, although the actual particular remedy that's being sought is quite small. Now, of course, that changes when it goes to the national stage and to Chicago and to the presidential election. And I think as a matter of it being about campuses, I think that's about to end, with the coming of final exams and the end of term. But, it's here, it's with us. I'm worried that Chadi may be correct that, even if Biden were to, use his leverage right now, and even if he were to do all the things that I think those people out in the streets want, he's probably not going to be able to change minds and to satisfy that block. So that's a thorny dilemma.
We will be watching this summer as it unfolds. This has actually been an interesting discussion that I think you guys actually share so much in terms of thoughts about how things could be brought back together, but whether that can happen is
nobody
a really
ever listens
open question.
To sensible people.
And on that note, well, thank you so much for joining me for this episode of Impromptu.
It has been a great pleasure, and let's do it again soon.
Yeah, and thanks so much for having us. It's great.
This episode was produced by Hadley Robinson, edited by Damir Marusek, Chris Solentrop, and Allison Michaels, and mixed by Emma Munger. Chris Rukan designed our art. Special thanks to Millie Mitra, Nick Safin, Renita Jablonski, and David Shipley. This week, we want to try something new. We have heard so many perspectives on this topic from even just our own columnists, but we know there are many more out there, and we would love to hear directly from you. Tell us what you think by sending a voice memo to impromptu@washpost.com. And remember, you can find Impromptu wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what you hear, please press that follow button so you can tune in every week. If you're a Washington Post subscriber, you can listen ad-free on Apple Podcasts when you connect your subscription.
This podcast is brought to you by Intel vPro. AI PCs built for business with Intel Core Ultra processors and Intel vPro are optimized for hundreds of AI apps and tools to boost user productivity. All with AI-powered threat detection. Learn more at intel.com/itheroes.
There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.